You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
What do widening inequalities of income and wealth, heightened job insecurity, and the spreading effects of global warming all have in common? They're all the logical outcomes of supercapitalism, claims former Secretary of Labor Robert B. Reich in his latest book, Supercapitalism, The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life. He argues that under the weight of supercapitalism, democracy is becoming increasingly less effective in dealing with these problems. The book is published by Knopf, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Professor Reich back to the show. Hello.
Leonard, it is good to see you again.
Is supercapitalism a word you've coined?
I don't know. It occurred to me as I was writing, trying to contrast what's happened and what I've seen and experienced happening over the last 30 years to both the economy and democracy. I wanted something that was neutral in the sense, I was thinking maybe hypercapitalism, but then I thought, no, there are good sides to this too, and I want to reframe the debate. So supercapitalism seemed most appropriate to me.
And you think it dates back about 30 years?
Certainly the transition that I'm talking about started around the 1970s. That's when we began to see globalization and technology and deregulation and a lot of things that have subsequently been attributed to Ronald Reagan. Actually, it started before Reagan.
And continued into the Clinton presidency.
Absolutely, with increasing escalation. I mean, I see this, the road to supercapitalism, as a road that we, as a society, without really spending much time thinking about it, as consumers and investors became more powerful, and as citizens we became less and less powerful, we just did it. And now we find ourselves at the start of the 21st century as consumers and investors actually pretty well off. As citizens, we are quite almost silenced.
Is a natural consequence of supercapitalism that it weakens democracy?
I didn't want to come to that conclusion when I started this research, started this book several years ago. But and I don't think it's inevitable, Leonard. I think that if we got our thinking straight about it, we could save democracy. But unfortunately, what's happened is that as consumers and as investors have become more powerful, and we're all consumers, and actually most of us are investors as well in terms of 401ks, we have lost the power as consumers because companies have overwhelmed Washington and other capitals with lobbying, often directed at each other, trying to avoid, it's kind of like an arms race. One company is there in Washington and its competitors have to be there to avoid getting, some piece of legislation that will hurt it competitively. But I saw it happening. I was in Washington in the 1970s in the Bush, in the Ford and then the Carter administration. And then I came back in the 1990s in the Clinton administration, and Washington had been transformed. We went, there were 7,000 lobbyists there in the 1970s, and now there are 35,000, 40,000. Washington is a glittering, rich city now. It used to be kind of drab and even almost a provincial city.
I know Ralph Nader isn't the most popular person in America with a lot of people in the Democratic Party, but on this show, he said that democracy was weakened when the Democratic Party, which up until that point had largely been supported by working people and supported working people, found that, like the Republican Party, it could make a lot of money from lobbyists and got addicted to the lobbyist money the same way that the Republicans had.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I saw it happen. And I document that in the book. But it happened because lobbyists began to have access to a lot of money. Back in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, early 70s, I call that the not quite golden age.
Because there were all sorts of endemic problems.
There were a lot of problems.
There was segregation. There was McCarthyism.
Of course,
there was
of course. But at least
rampant consumerism.
Leonard, at least we were on a road to, society with civil rights and with our efforts to clean up the environment, the environmental a Protection Act of 1970, I guess it was 70, 1970, we were trying as a society to rectify some of the negative side effects of capitalism. But what happened beginning in the late 70s is that we, in many respects, stopped trying. Democrats fell under the sway of the same lobbyists, but the lobbyists themselves became hugely more powerful. And the real distinction I draw is not so much between Democrats and Republicans, but between people who served in government in the 30 years ago versus people who served in the last 10 years. The last 10 years, a remarkable number became lobbyists.
Is this unique to the United States, or are we seeing a similar situation developing in other countries?
It's happening all around the world, although more places than ever call themselves democracies. They are crippled. Their democracies are crippled by the same things that are happening here. And super capitalism is all – even China – certainly not a democracy, but China has embraced capitalism. It's kind of authoritarian capitalism, and it apparently works. Singapore, authoritarian capitalism, not a whiff of democracy there, a very effective capitalist system. We used to think, and I thought this way in the 50s, 60s, 70s, that democracy and capitalism went hand in glove, that you couldn't have one without the other.
Milton Friedman's point, wasn't it?
It was Milton Friedman's point. I quote him in this book.
He said competitive capitalism is a necessary precondition to sustainable democracy.
Well, people read that quote as meaning that competitive capitalism would lead to democracy, but he didn't actually say that. He said a necessary precondition, but not a sufficient condition. I think if he were alive today, he would probably agree with much of what I say in this book, that even though it's necessary, a lot more has to be in a society, and a society has got to practice citizenship if you're going to have a real democracy. And if we lose our capacity to practice citizenship because we're so much oriented to being consumers and investors, and all of our media and all of our surroundings focus our attention on being consumers and investors, then we lose. We lose our democracy.
My guest is Robert B. Reich, former Secretary of Labor, now Professor of Public Policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's written a book called Super Capitalism, The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life, published by Knopp. Let's talk about China a bit more. So you're saying that Milton Friedman should not be criticized, as some have, for suggesting that with the opening up of, we're having economic democracy or capitalism, the growth of capitalism in China, that democracy would automatically follow.
I don't think he said that.
No, but some people have suggested that if you read him, that's what the conclusion you would come to. And many people have suggested that China will become a democracy ultimately because it has to, because markets are opening it up.
I think that's wrong. And a lot of the foreign policy of America with regard to China has been premised on the notion that, well, if we encourage them in terms of becoming a strong capitalist nation, inevitably they will become a democracy. I think that's wishful thinking. We may be seeing the birth of a new kind of capitalism in China. We have seen it for years in Singapore and elsewhere around the world. This is not new. I mean, you know, Hitler's Germany was, in a way, a capitalist country. It just had nothing to do with democracy. You can have capitalism without democracy. It was our conceit in the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s that we exemplified a necessary and inevitable connection between the two.
So it suggests that consumers and investors in some countries are so concerned with their range of choices that pushing for political freedom may not be one of their top priorities.
It may not be. Again, the United States foreign policy has been premised on the notion that if you have a big middle class, the large middle class who is prosperous will almost inevitably want political freedom. But why do we assume that that is the case necessarily? And why do we assume that even if they want political and civil rights, they will get it? You know, I was talking with some people from India, some business people from India recently, and they were India is a democracy, much more of a vivid and vital democracy, obviously, than India's major competitor, China. And they said, look, China wants to create universities. Well, boom, it creates universities. China wants the major research institutions in the world. Well, snaps its fingers, it can do it. Democracy is complex, time-consuming. Often there are different coalitions that can block various pieces of legislation. We here in India, said these Indian business people, we can't get things done nearly as efficiently as China. And they're going to be more successful than we are as capitalists, because they don't have to worry about democracy.
You mentioned the not-so-golden age of post-World War II United States. Of course, as we mentioned, there were all sorts of inequities here, and it was a system largely built on exclusion of people who weren't white and middle class. But still, it seemed to work. What happened in the 70s? It isn't that we got more democratic, was it?
No. The 50s and 60s, for all the faults of the 50s and 60s, and as I suggest in the book, you know, there were, as you just did, there were huge numbers of problems.
Well, we still had the Cold War. Was that good or bad?
Still, it was good for the economy. But inequality of income and wealth was far lower than it ever had been before in the United States since we've been keeping records, and far lower than it ever would be again. Everybody's income seemed to grow together, even though the economy was not nearly as vibrant as it is today, even though the Dow Jones was stuck in the 600s or 700s or 800s, even though innovation was not nearly as exciting as it's been, our democracy seemed to work better. We did eventually pass civil rights and voting rights acts. We did eventually do something about the environment. We did collectively believe we had a public voice. Most people, when asked, do you believe that our democracy works, 75% of Americans said yes. Now 25 to 30% say yes to the same questions. Most people are far more disillusioned with our democracy today.
We'll take a little break and we'll come back and look at some of the reasons for that. My guest is Robert B. Reich. Supercapitalism is his latest book, The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life, published by Knopf. Later on, Alan Alda gives us some of his answers to life's big questions, and then we'll take a look at the odd career of Japanese film star Sessua Hayakawa. And we will find out how data crunchers are beating the experts almost every time. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast. Robert B. Reich is here. His latest book is called Supercapitalism, The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life, and it is published by Knopf. So what happened in the 70s? Was it the development of new technologies, or was it the shift in the United States from an industrial to a post-industrial service-based economy?
Technology. Cargo ships, container ships, satellite communications technology essentially created a global economy such as we never had before. Also, certain industries like airlines, utilities, financial industries, they embrace new technologies to deregulate themselves and create more competition. And then, of course, by the 1990s, we had the internet, and people could be very efficient at shopping for themselves. Consumers and investors never had it so good in terms of choice and options. But you see, Leonard, the same forces that increased competition in the private sector, gave consumers and investors so much more power, also overwhelmed democracy. Because what I found in the 1990s when I went down to Washington was that it was almost impossible for the public to get a word in edgewise. Why? Not so much because, as the left often thinks, corporations banded together and created this great corporate conspiracy to keep you know, wages down and to keep the public out of democracy. It's more subtle than that, more complicated, but more interesting. It was actually the same super capitalist intense competitiveness. Every company needed to be in Washington to fight every other competitor. Google, you know, before it went public, stayed out of Washington. It becomes a public company in 2004, and suddenly it needs a fleet of lobbyists because its major competitors, Yahoo and Microsoft, are in Washington, and there are trade treaties, and there's intellectual property, and the tax issues, and Google can't afford not to be there. Well, multiply that across the economy, you get 40, 50,000 lobbyists, innumerable trade associations, PR specialists. They are all in Washington. The noise level is so intense that citizen values don't even make it on the radar screen.
But I remember the 1970s as a decade of crisis. I remember the oil crisis. I remember runaway inflation, people getting 20% interest on their CDs at the banks. And then the 80s, Ronald Reagan's tax cuts. That suggests a very different kind of economy than what you're talking about.
But jobs were more stable. Inequality was less pronounced, far less pronounced, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And also, as the economy got more productive, everybody gained. Whether you were in the top 20% or the bottom 20%, everybody's income went up. What we have seen as super capitalism has taken hold is that inequality has widened, jobs have become less secure. Productivity has gone up, but only the top 5%. In fact, the Census Bureau just reported last week that even though the economy is much larger than it was in 2000, the only group that's doing better than 2000, everybody else is doing worse, the only group doing better is the top 5%. So you have an economy that is no longer working for everybody.
And then we have a diminishing social safety net. But the public has voted for that, hasn't it? Many of those changes occurred during the 12 years of Republican control of the White House and Republican Congresses in some cases as well.
Well, Leonard,
I'm not saying the Republican Party is responsible.
No. I think the Democrats are equally responsible in many ways. I think lobbyists have overridden the Democratic Party as much as they've overridden the Republican Party. But when you say people voted for that, you know, voting is just a very tiny aspect of democracy. I mean, it's necessary. Yes, votes are important. If we didn't vote people in, we would have not even a semblance of a democracy. But democracy requires a public debate at some level, somewhere, over what is in the public interest. It requires that representatives be held accountable to the common good. It requires that we be organized in ways that we are not to achieve public purposes. And if we only rely on, you know, the end of the process or the beginning of the process called voting and say, well, presto, that's a democracy, we've missed the essence of democracy. We don't have a democracy now. And that means even though the consumer and investor part of our brains are doing quite well, the citizen parts of our brains that care about what we achieve together, worry about global warming, worrying about widening inequality, worry about unstable jobs for everybody, the citizen aspect of our brains is becoming shriveled and may not even exist in some places. I mean, in some people for much longer.
Most people don't associate democracy with the water definition that you have given us. But are you suggesting that the answer is to insulate the politicians from big money? How do we do that?
Well, I'm suggesting the answer is to get money out of politics. That's not a new answer. It's not a new idea. The great move toward corporate social responsibility. You know, I can hardly pick up a newspaper, magazine, or hear a program without hearing some corporate CEO saying, we are socially responsible. Look what we're doing here and there. Well, by my standard, corporate responsibility and corporate social responsibility means getting out of politics, getting corporate money out of politics. I say to CEOs, you are not socially responsible if you hire a platoon of lobbyists in Washington. If it means anything, corporate responsibility, corporate social responsibility means stop corrupting the political process.
And, of course, they're going to tell you that if I don't do it, then my competitor gets a leg up, gets an unfair advantage.
Exactly. And it's an arms race. But like any arms race, there would be some advantages to American corporations if every competitor called a truce and rolled it back. They don't want to spend all this money on lobbyists if they don't have that.
Well, then we have to have Congress pass bills that would actually change things, but that's unlikely.
Congress is not going to. The little campaign finance reform stuff that we've had and the
and McCain the ethics, has even kind of disavowed
the ethics reform,
some of what he
it's not going to Congress support. Is not going to reform itself from the inside because there are too many people who have a vested interest in the status quo. What I say to my friends who are in the environmental movement or the civil rights movement or the gay rights movements or the women's rights movements or any kind of – even friends who are conservatives who are worried about the crassness and coarseness of commercial television and radio and the internet, I say to them, look, all of your efforts are fine, but unless you focus, number one, on making democracy work, you can just – be whistling in the wind. Nothing is going to happen. Nothing. We have politicians in Washington who say and act as if they are doing things for the common good. We have politicians in Washington on both sides of the aisle who will, for example, hold hearings on BP, the oil company, when its pipes created environmental disaster in Alaska, and scold those executives, or scold the executives of Google and Microsoft for abusing human rights in China. And that scold is the end of the story. You know, the politicians get off. They don't have to pass any legislation. The public feels, oh, isn't that nice? We can rest more easily now that the executives are scolded. And the executives go back and do exactly what they were doing before. It's a sham.
Isn't the system of democracy better suited for a smaller population? And there are people who claim that we're really a republic because and make a certain kind of distinction there.
Well, undoubtedly, the practice of democracy starts in communities and in neighborhoods, but it doesn't end there. I mean, we become adept at practicing democracy because we work at the grassroots level. But if we just basically say that's all there is to it and forget that we're in a nation and forget there are these great forces and great pieces of legislation and great regulatory regimes that are affecting all of us every day and say, well, we can't affect that. You know, if we indulge in that kind of cynicism, then we're giving away the shop.
My guest is Robert B. Reich. His latest book, Supercapitalism, The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life, is published by Knopf. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What does it mean for our democracy as more people are gaining wealth and investing in the stock market?
Well, I don't think that's a bad thing. I try in this book to emphasize that the more choices we as consumers have, and the more people, we're up to about 51% of households have some investments in the stock market. That's not bad. That's good. Particularly good if the stock market does well. But you see the volatility in the stock market right now, increasing volatility, increasing number of trades, increasing number of speculators. A lot of small people, small not in terms of height, I'm small height-wise, but small people in terms of just average citizens, are getting hurt because they can't easily compete on the same grounds in the stock market as some of the big funds, the hedge fund managers, for example. And therein lies, again, a piece of the story, because no market can really function well and fairly unless there are rules to guide it. And those rules have to come from somewhere, and the best place for those rules to come is from a democratic process.
But part of the problem is that many of these companies are large global corporations. They really are not subject to one country's jurisdiction or another. They function as little international entities unto themselves.
Well,
how do you rein them in?
I would give credence to that argument if we were living in, you know, a little tiny country like Luxembourg. But the United States is the most powerful economy in the world. Every company in the world has to sell and do business in the United States if it is really going to make money. Therefore, we have huge leverage over every global company because we can always say to them, if you're not going to play by our rules, you don't get to come here.
But our regulatory agencies seem to be pulling back from setting those rules or imposing those rules. And that was something that occurred when you were in government as well.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not
you
defending...
You were Secretary of Labor at a time when the unions were in serious decline.
I am not defending the Clinton administration, Leonard. And I'm also, I mean, I'm the first to admit I and we did not achieve nearly what I or we wanted to or should have during the Clinton administration. I am a kind of bipartisan critique criticizer here. But you say that, you know, our agencies of government, our democratic system has not performed as it should for our people, and that's been going on for years. And I say, yes, exactly. But it's not because of a kind of corporate conspiracy. It's because this the consumer and investor side of our brains, wanting better and better deals, have not understood that in getting better and better deals from all over the world, we are, in a sense, shooting ourselves in the feet because we, in pursuit of those great deals, are losing our capacity to understand and make social decisions about the consequences of those deals.
Many people have pointed out the irony of all of the people who see money to be made as a result of global warming. Now suddenly areas that once were just impossible to drill for oil in or to send ships through are now have now become available to us. And I just heard this morning a report on Canadian diamond mining in areas that would have been impossible in the past. This is more of the same sort of thing you're talking about, isn't it?
It is. I mean, most Americans, I think, by now are convinced that there is global warming. I mean, there is some right-wing craziness still contending there isn't, but most Americans are convinced there is. And I think most Americans actually would like to do something about it and might even be willing to pay for a slowing down or reversing of it, maybe a carbon tax, which we would all have to pay for. I mean, it means that our goods and services become that much more expensive because we can't pollute the atmosphere. But how do we ever get to the point where the consumer or investor side of our brains that wants the best deals, doesn't want to pay all this extra, really engages the citizen on us that would be willing to, because our politics is not addressing these trade-offs. Everybody running for the presidency today is sort of saying to us, in effect, as they always do, oh, don't worry, we can do this free. Oh, not going to raise your taxes. No, we're going to attack, we're going to provide health care. We're going to attack the problems with the environment. We're going to do all these things and just you won't have to make any sacrifices at all. It's a continuation of the no sacrifice theory of citizenship, which is really treating people as consumers and investors rather than as citizens.
And at the same time, American citizens continue to lose confidence in democracy as a way of responding to their concerns.
Exactly. I mean, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't practice citizenship, and if nobody else does, if you see yourself more of a consumer as a consumer and investor than you do as a citizen, then all of that begins to atrophy. The institutions that we used to have, I mean, 30, 40 years ago, we had labor unions, we had local political organizations, we had political parties, we had a lot of apparatus that approximated the kind of bargaining that could get to the common good. We don't have that today.
Isn't that the trend elsewhere as well?
Yes.
Sarkozy just became president of France, promising the same sort of thing that American presidents have promised.
Supercapitalism is taking over the world. We're in the vanguard. That is, the United States is setting the trend. And so
I guess we should be proud.
Well, look, we can be proud of our economy in terms of its dynamism and innovation. I mean, conservatives have that right, but they're missing the other part of the equation. And that other part of the equation is critically important. The bottom line is that capitalism and democracy don't necessarily go hand in glove any longer. We're losing our democracy. Our capitalism is very robust. But unless we actually understand how to take our democracy back, we are in grave danger.
And you have solutions in this book?
I do have solutions. I offer some options. I don't think that they are necessarily the end of the discussion. I want to start and stimulate a discussion. For example, I think with regard to political contributions to candidates, there ought to be blind trusts. So nobody's First Amendment rights to contribute to candidates are being assaulted, but the candidates have no way of knowing who contributed what. The advantage there, Leonard, is that nobody can be paid back because the candidate can't pay anybody back. Everybody says, well, I contributed to your campaign. Well, the candidate doesn't know who contributed. So there, you get rid of the corruption that way, or at least you make a dent in the corruption. Or, for example, a lot of states have paycheck protection acts, they call them. If you're a member of a union, you don't have to pay union dues to support union political activity you disagree with. Why not shareholder protection acts? So if you're a shareholder, you don't like what your company is doing in Washington with its political action committee, you can get that portion, that pro rata portion of the profits of the company back. A lot of things that we can do, but in order to do anything, we've got to get citizens motivated and directed, and we've got to get all of these shards of public interest that we still have and public interest activists who are still out there who are doing this or that or global warming or civil rights or whatever they're doing and get them to focus on the most important prerequisite for anything else, and that is getting money, particularly corporate money, out of our democracy.
Robert B. Reich is professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. His latest book is Super Capitalism, The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again today.
Leonard, it's a pleasure.
Robert Reich will be speaking and signing books tonight at 7:30 at the Lincoln Square Barnes & Noble store. Up next, Alan Alda discusses what he learned when he set out to make his life as meaningful as possible. And then later on, we'll take a look at the actor Sessio Hayakawa, who was once as popular as Charlie Chaplin. And then we'll find out how number crunching can affect everyday life in ways you might not suspect. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite.